Welcome to the AI and Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, the show where we spotlight the innovators and leaders who are transforming the future using the power of data and AI. I'm your host, Dean Gaeta, author, podcaster, and founder and CEO of Infogistics and Slingshot. We're living in an exciting era, a time where builders, leaders, and entrepreneurs are using data and AI to fuel unprecedented growth, create groundbreaking products, and drive meaningful transformations in their industry. If you're ready to learn from some of the brightest minds and uncover actionable insight to take your business to the next level, you're in the right place. And if you have a story to share, stick around until the end of the show. We'll tell you how you can become our next guest and inspire leaders around the globe. Welcome to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. Let's dive in. All right, so here we go.
By the way, I'm assuming, Dean, that there are certain acronyms, usually in the four-letter variety, that we should let fly here. However, not knowing the audience that your luscious voice and embodiment listen to, what's the titration need to be in terms of my vocabulary?
I say you just be you. And it's people you interact with. It's technologists. It's entrepreneurs. It's CEOs. It's all across the board. So I always say you be you. I mean, that's how I live my life. So you be you. And so good to see you. We used to see each other all the time at Pop Tech. And I love that you're so into design and you're crazy. So go ahead. Just be you.
Oh, that's great. When you're being introduced as a nutball. But it's true. So I can't run away from that. Yeah, it was 20 years ago we met. My God. Was it 20 more? No, is more. It something like that? What the
it's
hell
more.
Was it?
Yeah, it was. I don't remember the year because it's getting old now. But people don't know you like I know you. So you should just maybe give it a little intro to yourself so everyone could understand the context of where you come from. And no one will understand your craziness, but that's okay.
Okay. Thanks, Dean. I appreciate even just giving 17.6 minutes here today. That's probably 17 minutes too much for most people to listen to my BS. But my name's Johan. I pretend to run a design firm in Boston. And I also, on the side, teach at a private equity firm, otherwise known as MIT. And most of my time is designing the future of software in the healthcare space and for the enterprise and screwing it up for people who actually buy part of my brain.
It's funny that you say MIT's private equity company, MIT. Like, why do you say that?
Why do you think? How much money is in the MIT trust at the moment?
I don't know.
You want to make a guess?
$40 billion.
Okay, so that's damn close. It's Harvard's is 50, right? That's the real private equity firm of the nation. Then MIT is about half that. It's about 25. Yeah. Now, what's insane, too, is that, well, that's a ton of money. It's basically a real estate firm with an academic goiter on top of it, right? It's crazy to think about how much money is in play here, how much money they can raise, and what is the business of academic institutions like that. They're not alone. Stanford is similar. All the big institutions are real estate firms. And that's where a ton of their money and income and investment comes from. Some understandable, some nuts.
Yeah, I love there's just so much innovation coming out of MIT, then gets commercialized. Yeah, I've always loved the MIT brand. And I always said if I wasn't so mischievous as a young lad, I would have gone to MIT, but I didn't have all the 4-point whatever you need to get in there at the time. But
that's okay. Look how well you've done, Dean.
Yeah.
It's not like you've done too poorly because your grit, I don't need to plug that, has been pretty damn good. And look, there's a couple points to MIT. As much as I just pooped on all over it right there, it is an amazing institution. I am lucky in a lot of ways to be in part of that orbit, that gravitational pull that finds weird, interesting people and exports and builds and mens e manus is the core idea that MIT was built on, mind and hand. And that is a fantastic coupling of what we're seeing now and forever in technology, forever in culture, where you have to manifest things physically or in reality, however you do that, in order for humans to get it. and for it to have an impact on the species or the planet. If you do things only in vaporware, that only goes so far. Right. So there is this, it's a fantastic institution that way. But every organization, every company, my company, look, I'm running a company that no one should ever have me running anything. But we all have our peccadilloes. We all have our problem humans and child within us. And so MIT is no stranger to that. Neither is Harvard, neither is any of the biggies, where the administration bloat has gotten high. The idea that virtual education, you know, when they pay so much to be on campus, is fine versus, hey, no, we're going to make the experience amazeballs for those who attend the university. And at the same time, give access to the entire spaceship Earth to get access to those classes and take them so that the tuition is actually funding the planetary education, not just those that come. So
yeah,
again, there's a lot of good and bad parts to universities. I don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth.
No. These days, like, you're in design and, like, we're a design-led engineering software company. And, like, what can you share about, like, how things change? I know things have changed for us with AI where, like, we still need UI, visuals, and then interactive flow and experience and everything. But now we're, like, asking our teams to now start designing in conversational and AI experiences. Like, what do you have thoughts around that?
About how AI is infusing itself like a virus inside of our production process and making?
More about the UX, because like we have requirements and then we have Figma designs and we have designs and interactions, but now there's a whole nother like flow of how we have to build the experience. Yeah, to infuse AI. And how do you guys do it? Do you think about that? Or?
Sure. One is, if you're not thinking about it, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Because it is a whirlwind. It is around us has an amazing promise. I'm pretty bullish on it. And I am wide-eyed about it as well, knowing that there is not a zero-sum chance we're hoisted by our own petard and destroyed by it. Knock on wood, that doesn't happen. But if you're not infusing it into your work right now, you're doing yourself a disservice. The first thing, if you mentioned design, engineering, and the making part of this, is there is real research that has proven time and time again that the more ideas you have about an idea or problem solution set, the more you're going to get good ideas. Let's cut it back. When you're in the thick of making things, and for us, Dean, your teams and my team are in similar spaces of software, right? Digital things on your silicon bricks in our pockets or our desktops, whatever the frick. What AI allows us to do is come up with a shit ton more ideas early. It's this Uzi, so often indiscriminate, somewhere in the radar of what we're trying to do, often not completely on target, but the population of ideas has exponentially jumped. And that's been proven over and over again. In fact, one of my colleagues in course two in mechanical engineering at MIT has several papers on this, which says, hey, look, the people who come up with more ideas for a solution set, for a problem, will almost always have better ideas inside of those solution sets.
Yeah.
And so what it does now is we can get 150 weird ideas out there, and we can then amplify them. We can come up with our own. Maybe we'll have 250 by the end of it and explore faster and better for things that may work. And that's the beginning problem set of when you're designing software and you're designing things and experiences. And that to me already off the bat, boom, amazing leap in how we do things.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you use it as a collaborator to come up with a whole bunch of different ideas that you can explore and experiment with.
Or helps with the process so that I still draw with ink and papyrus. But if you then amplify that with, hey, draw this kind of things, I can put together even a comic strip or of an idea in the same time with me doing one frame. And it makes no sense for me to draw out a whole comic of a use case, or I'm just making this up, and not use render help from services. So now I can do five in the same time it took me to do one.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden that allows me to test ideas, to see if they have legs, to iterate and keep going and make them better and better.
So has your course or your subjects that you teach at MIT,
Subjects, yes.
How have they changed a lot because of generative AI, or how?
Well, they're changing now. There's the idea of there are still schools who want students to do P sets, problem sets, and do the same work that a machine can do in a fraction of the time. That seems ridiculous. Even a couple of years ago, we mandated the use of Gen AI and AI in our design classes, design engineering classes, because we know they weren't going away. They were just going to get better and better over time. And so you have to learn how to use them, and the pedagogy of learning has to shift. So we want to make sure that the students and faculty and mentors and teachers can explain what's happening. And that is the important part, is can you explain the concept? Can you understand why it got to the answer? And then that, to me, is the critical nature of these things. And that's how we're shifting, is we're asking for explanations and how the models should work, not give me the exact answer. So there's this great idea of when I was younger, we had to figure out how a gear worked and the involute ratios and things like that. That's insane doing that now, because there are AI services and regular machine services that are visual and mathematical simultaneously to show you exactly the gear ratios and the gearing for things. You don't need to do that by hand. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so this is a sort of a great evolution of the education, and also a hard one, is now we need these AI services to mentor us through some of these processes, do those things automatically, but we understand the theory, the underlying idea of how that is driven. We don't need to know all the math that goes into that anymore, which is pretty great.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know what I really worry about, and maybe you have since you're a professor and you teach.
No, I'm just a regular schmuck.
I just worry about the hype that big tech has around AI. No more developers, no more this, no more that. It's so far from that. And I worry that people won't study science, technology, math, computer science, because we need these people. And do you see that amongst the students, or because it's so far from the truth? We need critical thinkers, inventors, problem solvers, and you need to learn all this skill and keep learning and leverage AI for sure as a collaborator. But the hype that's out there is just ridiculous.
I'm not sure I completely agree, Dean, is that I am nervous about the need for highly technical humans over time.
Really?
Or even low tech. I think high tech for the next probably decade will be still in need, like chief engineers who have 20 years experience plus, because software is still brittle. I'm talking in the software world and hardware. Okay. Software is still brittle.
Yeah.
Especially when machines make it and when humans make it. And we're going to need people who have built bridges before, built software before, to understand the sort of the critical components and how they work. But over time, I think we are going to have to figure out, what do people do when that kind of mass scale engineering we can use machines for? And that keeps me up about what the frick am I going to do? Because when I say coding, it's the same as design, right? And experience design and UI design. Now, I think what will happen is there'll be this diversion of maybe, who the hell knows? What the hell do I know? But in design, at least, there might be a couple different paths, but two major ones with maybe 80% of the humans will go into a much more of a facilitation role. Is this what we really want to do? How do we know it? How do we gather people to make sure this is the right idea? Especially in big enterprises with several thousand people or 20,000, 50,000, how do you make better and better decisions with humans and machines working together? And that needs a kind of design. And I'm not necessarily great at that, but that will, I think more people will gravitate towards that from raw UI to work, for instance. But there will be a small percentage who are involved in the tooling of those services that help that 80%. And this is part of what you're doing in Fragistics, is you're making these tool sets, these underpants for how people can quickly make other tools. Yeah. And I still think there is a smaller crowd of humans who will be involved in the tooling of AI, the tooling of software services that then humans and AI use together. I still think I'll live in part of that world, because of my pretend knowledge of design and humans and technology. But I think that'll be shrinking.
So what about someone that maybe has a kid 10 years from now, is going to enter college? Like, what would your advice be to them if they were going to head into a scientific innovation, technology, or just big problem solving realm? What do you have thoughts on that?
I don't have any thoughts. I'm a moron.
But
you don't think that there's going to be some huge pulsing amazingness with mentorship and teaching using AI services?
Yeah.
You know, that's an obvious one for me.
The state of AI now is so far from what everyone's talking about, where, like, even what you're talking about, like, we don't need these highly skilled problem solving people because.
Oh, we're going to need them, but just
LMs
different kind of jobs.
Like, they're horrible at math, first of all. They are terrible at math. And they're probabilistic instead of deterministic outcomes. And then you can keep asking for, it's great to collaborate with, but you can keep asking a question and it keeps giving you a lot of different variations on the answer. And then it takes so much software scaffolding to get it to be more deterministic, to build different pieces of something. And I don't know, that people think, oh, more infinite memory and where they can remember everything. But I just see this huge distance. But we could do a disservice to the next generation if they're not learning like critical thinking and.
A piece. Amen to that. I agree,
yeah.
Dean, on the end of that statement that, hey, we still have, as humans, a lot to do to increase our intellect.
Yeah.
But I'm also hoping at the same time that as much as some parts may be decreased, that we will have this sort of education crown that we can put on at any time to learn new things pretty fast in a way that we will uptick faster. So the idea of one size fits 30 kids in a classroom, I think hopefully will melt in slowly, that there'll be much more hyper-personalized mentoring going on.
Yeah, that would be amazing. I think that will happen. Yeah.
Because how often are you talking to, I don't know what you call her, chatty. That's what Harry Sleeper calls her, if you remember Harry. I talked to chatty, and when she was telling me, and it's really OpenAI's voice module, right? I use it like maybe 40 minutes a day at a minimum. How are you using her or it in your everyday life like that?
Yeah, that's it. So how do you use AI? What kind of tips you can give, like how you're leveraging it and for the different work you do?
Oh, I'm highly promiscuous in my uses, from everything from just talking to her. She is a pretty fantastic way for me to communicate just ideas. Hey, tell me about 1967 and what Israel was doing and blah, blah, blah. I'll go through like history with it a lot just to get context of current events. That's one way. Another way is, hey, what if I did this? What if I did this? What are the five options here? I will not agree with them often. But another thing I did is the questions you were going to ask me, which we haven't done any of those. You sent over
questions.
Yeah, use
one. You can use one.
I put them all into GPT, and then I looked at them all. I said, shit, I'm not going to answer any of these like this. This is not how I – even because it knows how I supposedly talk. Anyways, so I didn't use any of them, but it allows me to learn things and query, and I use it all the time. We use it now all the time in the software building with a cursor and lovable, all sorts of kinds of fast tools to come up with quick ideas. That's fantastic. And so we use it up and down the stack, and I am going to love, really love, when it gets so good that UIs will change depending on who I am. This idea that UIs are static. User interfaces are static, not uploaded intelligence, that interfaces we use are static are insane. It should mold itself based on who I am, how I use it, what I should learn. And that to me is where I think the interestingness of AI really takes UI way farther.
So would it be the same UI for you for all applications? Or like when it says it knows who you are, is it based on how you're using it for what app you're using?
Yeah, sure, shit. If I'm pretending to make some music with some teenage engineering, a little thing, which has some of the best UIs, I think, on the planet, they do beautiful design, teenage engineering. Highly
really
recommend.
Check that out.
They're awesome. A little Swedish firm, of course they're Swedish, outside Stockholm, and they do weird really well. So where are you going with this is, God damn.
Yeah, I was just trying to understand how, like, your vision of adaptable
UI
AI. Well, How would it adapt to what? To your mode,
Yeah,
to what?
everything. Shoot, if I'm wanting to make something, a piece of software, or design 50 ideas for something, and I haven't used a piece of software before, or haven't done it before, there might be three different modes for me to get into it. And then once I'm getting into it, you always design software for the intermediate first, almost always, unless it's like an emergency door to get out of a plane, because you only want to use that once, or typically never. But for the most part, when you're using software, you design for people who use it more than just a couple times. You're because they want to gain proficiency, right? They want to, and so part of that gaining proficiency is learning the UI. So why isn't the service bending itself based on the models that I'm trying to figure out? Oh, what do I do here? Why do I want to do this? And that to me is how interfaces and services are going to morph.
Yeah, that's
You know, this is not a new concept. I think that's been around for decades. It's just we haven't
too
been close.
expensive to do it. Yeah, it's so expensive to do it.
But now that's changed. Now we're going to see that change.
Yeah, that's good. So what questions should I be asking you now? Go ahead and read from the favorite questions that you
I
have
don't have a
there.
favorite in there. Screw it, Dean. We're just.
You don't have a favorite in there?
That's like, what's my favorite child? Oh, yeah, I do have
Well,
those.
just a question from there.
Oh, God. What do we talk about?
I like I'm this old. I love seeing the cassette.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You have a 3.5 diskette. That means you're not that old.
No, I had five inch in my 08. Wasn't mine. It was my dad's 086 IBM.
I
You probably had one of those or some
had one of those.
facsimile.
I love
Okay.
it.
But that's also a different era. And our generation, I think it's no surprise that we're the last to have been born in the non-digital world.
Yeah.
And there is something I think important about that in the survival of the species, hopefully, is the ability to function sans, phone in your hand, function without an immediate, where the frick am I? And that to me is still, it's not a luxury for me because it's part of our DNA, both of
Yeah.
us. But what it does is it helps with levels of uncertainty in these days is that, yes, we're surrounded by chaos in some ways we are because the megaphones are just bigger. Maybe it's the same amount of chaos, just we're hearing a lot more shit.
Yeah.
But in the world of uncertainty, which business lives in a lot of the time, I think it helps when you can morph between analog digital versus just being digital only.
Yeah.
I think that's a benefit, a net benefit for us. But maybe over time, hopefully, I'll be proven wrong.
Yeah, whether it's analog or digital, it's always the time to think and think things through and focus. And yeah, digital gets interrupts you too much. And but I guess like kids are getting better at that. I don't know, but maybe not. And AI is probably going to add to it, but you know what? This may not be a fair question, but I was just curious. I wonder, like, what institutions like MIT and other educators, like, how are they seeing the future of education? Because I still worry deeply about that. That if you think humans can check out, no friggin' way. And so we need to keep educating the next generation. Maybe it's a not fair question because you're not. You mean your design, your engineering, your. I don't know, but do you know what's going on there? Or?
No, I can't speak for the institution as a whole, but you do still need fluency in tools of the day, right? There are design methods, right? That's like how we design things like that. You need modeling and representation knowledge, right? That's thinking and defining things, right? There's the disciplinary knowledge, right? The domain fundamentals. That's not the, and I think the, There are probably other things I'm missing, but you need the broad knowledge of context and history, right? And so I think those are pretty important still. And AI is not going to take over all of those things, right? The human part of broad knowledge, of disciplinary knowledge, of the domain fundamentals, there's a combination that you're going to need to play together. That's why AI and machines working together to diagnose patients are way better doing it together than they are separately. And so I think that's part of your point, which I agree with, is these humans and machines will need to work together over time to come up with better and better results.
Yeah, that's who I see the future is just collaborating, but you need that foundation. If you're going to be a medical doctor or an engineer or a designer, you need all that learning and foundation as a basis for your domain or for the processes and the way you figure out problems. I'm always a big advocate to not believe the hype about AI, but also, and believe the hype of AI, but that doesn't mean you don't need to like skill up and learn a lot of different ways to solve problems and have domain knowledge in whatever field you choose to go in, because just ask the AI. It's ask the AI to keep learning and have new ideas, but you need that. So it's like social media. Oh, it's amazing, but then it screwed up a whole generation of kids being able to be focused and be social and but then it has good parts to it too, but it has a lot of bad, like that bad consequences. So I worry about that with AI, particularly around just people studying and getting educated in and thinking they have an opportunity to put all that time and effort in for the future.
We're still going to need humans to have this appetite, this hunger to create things.
Yeah.
And that has to c also come with David Wallace, one of my colleagues who's a real professor at MIT, is a black sheep a little bit, and he uses that as a badge of honor so that you can be free from the flock, right? And do weirder and weirder things and not settle just for good enough.
Yeah,
Right.
I love it.
And so I really, if you want to see more about what how his philosophy works, which I think is fantastic, he's got a whole video series called playseriously.com. And that sort of outlines how he teaches, and I happen to teach with him in that class,
Oh,
the
cool. I'm
design
going to check
class
it
at
out.
MIT, to
Yeah.
playseriously.com.
Yeah, I'm going to check that out. Now, what question didn't I ask you that you said, oh, I wish Dean would ask me that?
Dean,
No.
part of this is
No
it's also
punting,
just
no
great to see
punting,
you.
no
It's
punting.
I'm not I'm punt I'm punting in terms of I don't know what questions to ask me. I always feel bizarre when someone asks me about what's your process and how do you get inspired. I don't know that crap.
Yeah,
It
you
just
do.
happens. But what I w part of how we met is also what has made me think about the future and what we should do and how we should do it. And that was through a conference called PopTech.
Yeah.
And it was really fantastic for a good 20 years almost,
Yep.
where 500 people with interesting, sharp, not always agreeing humans got into a really small, a beautiful place in Camden, Maine, and talked about ideas that shape education, technology, politics, and media. And the things I was exposed to there, I think for me, have had not an insignificant ding on my boomerang or line of sight. And it's changed me. And one small thing, other than meeting the people like you there, has also been a concentration or focus on if we want to change things, sometimes it helps to change the law. Not always, but sometimes. And in healthcare, that is specifically true. So one output of that is why haven't I gotten more into the policy world? Boy, it's painful. I have scars. I haven't done a great job at it. However, it is one of many of these intellectual outbursts that arrived from when we met there over the past a couple decades that has helped shaped where I've gone.
Yeah, that's
Um,
amazing.
and I just think it's been a fantastic, I think, outlet for many of us. And
Yeah,
not
I
as
mean,
many people, and more people need to be out part of it.
yeah, that PopTech, like those events are amazing because what you described, it's all these different creative people coming together in a beautiful setting and then just learning different ideas and thoughts on, yeah, in design, music, tech, everything. And the most interesting part is like meeting cool people, and then it just makes your mind think differently, which is great for people that want to invent and create. It like opens it up, and yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Like those are, yeah. And I'm sad that PopTech left Camden and not going anywhere, but it was amazing for decades, as you said.
You know, what was also fantastic was there was a Robert Medcalf used to stand up at the end, remember?
Yeah.
For those who don't know, he's an inventor of the Ethernet and a total nobody. He would get up at the end and give a critique. Like he would do handwritten notes and he'd get up in front of everybody in the crowd usually, like just stand up in the crowd and give like an 8 minute like review or summary. And he'd go to town. He's not exactly, I don't align with him politically, but he's a sharp frickin' cookie. And
Yeah.
he also made me think about what did I overthink or what did I underthink?
Yeah.
And that was precious and not the bad way. It was really
Yeah.
a very good idea of how to have a dialogue.
Yep, no doubt. It's interesting. I would love to see medical change and change their culture and attitude. Because my daughter, I don't know if she's actually a nurse at Tufts in the bar there, and
No.
she's been there for a year and a half, and it's a level one trauma center, and I'm really proud of her because she was an EMT during college, and that's how come she could like all of a sudden right out of
Fantastic.
school go into a major ER level one place like Tufts in a major city like Boston. But I got to tell you, the culture of how doctors have to go through, like, just you would never accept it in your company, like abuse, 20-hour work shifts, work for free, be critical of what they're doing, not in a kind way. And then it's like the whole culture, then a lot of the culture just in the medical field, it like it's mind-boggling. And I even work with other software companies that are doing serious work in the medical field, and they have a whole bunch of PhD doctors working with them and building out software. And yeah, it's like a culture that you wouldn't intend, it's a culture you designed not to have. You may not agree with me from that point of view, or you may agree with me, I don't know, but it's okay. We need to collaborate, be open-minded, not open-minded, but like collaborate and not be so like abusive and abusive, like an hour's work, not get. And I don't know, like it was explained to me by the one CEO that runs a big medical software company. He's like, yeah, that's how they grew up. So it's like they're that way. It's like they, since they had it done to them, then now they're doing it to others. I'm like, that's horrible. I don't know if you have a thought on that
That you bring up 45 different points in one there,
or. I mean,
of
it's
which
easy.
coalesce into
It's
crazy. Yes,
crazy.
I think many people will make the point that healthcare is not nearly good enough as it should be in the disunited States. Okay,
Yeah.
that's hard to argue. And have we designed it that way over the last 100 years? Yes. And 100 years ago, what an amazing experience. The doctor would come to your house, right?
Yeah, we effed that up. Now
Yeah,
they
we
work for
did.
40 hours, make critical decisions on your life, which they're not at their cognitive best.
Yeah, look, and there's so many things to nibble at here, but in terms of your daughter working at Tufts in the ED, that's a tough job. That's a really tough job. And that's a life and death situation. And there are different protocols that, until you probably live the scenario of being in the surgery ward for a couple of weeks in the ED, that my God, there are reasons, there's some at least okay reasons for how the protocol works. Doesn't mean that all of them are right. But the second you distance yourself from the ED when life or death becomes a little different, right? That gradient of the decision
Yeah,
changes.
a little more.
It feels like it gets still just as hard to make the decision. And maybe that's part of the risk aversion gene that's also happened in healthcare, where the IRBs, the lawyers, the institutional review boards that governs how care works or the research it works, their default answer is what? No. So when you want to do these kind of things, you have entrenched process, protocol, humans, everything work and grinding against the new ideas that come in. And some of that time, it's supposed to be like that because, just like in democracy, what's messy, it takes several different ways to get policy to move. We have probably made it too hard on all fronts to get new ideas through. That's why people have been leaving major medical centers and going elsewhere. Like Boston has lost some really good healthcare humans over the past decade because the risk aversion gene is in high expression mode at the moment.
Yeah, that's so unfortunate. It's not just risk aversion, but also just the way we're teaching everyone to collaborate and get along. And yeah, I was just amazed. So I got exposed to it just through my daughter. Like she loves her teams. Her team's great, but then they're understaffed. So then it's like you would never do that. Like you would never understaff so that it's at a ratio where you can't give the proper care at life or death situations.
Well, life or death, yeah, it's a little weird, but we understaff in software all the time.
But that's
So
okay. Like we don't understand. Every company understaffs from everyone's point of view. But the point is, if you talk to me, yeah, we have to ship by a certain date, and we don't. Quality first. So like, of course, we have to have dates because we need a rhythm and we need to compete and go to market. But always quality first. So fine, push the date out. Push the date out. But that allows for like good work, quality work, innovation, but you still have to have some pace and rhythm to get to market. But so I would just state that. It's not okay, just ship it because we hit the date. That's like how that's my analogy in the medical world. Okay, 10 patients, you should have five. Okay, just deal with it. Make your best. Do your best. You have a deadline of taking care of 10 people. Oh,
Yeah, some of those people may die if you don't take care of them in any
that's my
way.
point. It's
Yes.
like, oh my God, really? I don't know. I just thought maybe I'm just telling you, maybe you could do something about it because 12-hour shifts, all these, it's like the physical, mental capacity you can have at working long hours and being having too many patients. And then it's not like shipping software. It's like people could die. It's, yeah, so.
If only we could legalize a certain level of pharmaceutical, that may help my brain a bit.
I'm sure that doesn't stop you. It's America. There's no.
But nowadays, there's a big, this is not a silly transition, but the idea of psychedelics are may get legalized, right, to use in treatment. And
I'm all
so
for that.
there are all sorts of weird things that are happening at the edges, which I have hope for.
Yeah, I mean that like we've had this culture where it's bad, but yet it there's some can be some serious innovation with psychedelics and how it opens up the brain, and I'm all for that.
What
So
else, Queen Dean? Did I screw up your day already? I think I did.
no, let's wrap up here, but like you don't want me to ask you the question I didn't ask you, so you don't want to answer that. That means we've covered everything you wanted to cover, but I'll give you one last chance.
No, we're good. We are
Okay.
totally good.
So if people wanted to like learn more about you, your company, some of the teachings you do, how will they get in touch with you?
If they want to make the grave professional mistake of looking at our work and our designs and software, you can go to GoInvo, GoInvo.com to see what we jam on a daily and monthly and yearly time frame, where some of our internal software is open source because we think the more open healthcare is, the more people can use it and adopt the ideas. But then we do quite a bit of closed source software for the enterprise.
Awesome. I'm glad that you came on the podcast. And yeah, we got to reconnect because I miss seeing you in Camden and I always enjoy talking to you. So thank you for coming on the show.
Anytime, Dean. Great to see you.
All right. Thank you.
Ciao.
Hey, it's Dean Guida here. Thank you so much for tuning in to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, where we showcase the visionaries who are shaping the future with data and AI. If you're a successful leader, entrepreneur, or business professional and want to share your story on this program, we'd love to hear from you. Visit us at podcast.slingshotapp.io to apply. Got something value out of this interview? Share the love. Take a quick screenshot, post it to your favorite social platform, or text it to a friend. Don't forget to tag the show and use the hashtag AI Data Driven Leadership. I love seeing your posts and suggestions for future guests. And if you know someone who would make a great guest, let them know about the show. We're dropping new episodes regularly, so don't miss out. Hit subscribe wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed this episode, a quick thumbs up, rating, or review would mean the world to me and my team. Want to stay connected? Visit our website at podcast.slingshotapp.io or find me on LinkedIn at Dean Guida. And Instagram at DeanGuida89. Thanks again for listening to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. We'll see you next time.